Doogie.
Sam.
We made it to episode 2.
Hooray!
And domestic football returns this weekend, which means one thing is for sure. The scrutiny of Erik ten Hag will continue.
If you're going to sack him, they should have in the summer.
When you've got 75,000 fans booing your decisions, you're missing something if you don't think it's important that those people are not happy with you and you want to wander into a press conference and start talking about bloody Harry Potter.
It's not like I'm Harry Potter.
I don't think you have to sack him. He needs more time.
You'd be worried for the manager. The pressure must be building. I'd hate this tag if I was playing that you're a cup team.
There's always going to be question marks because of the manner of what happened last year, but I honestly believe that Erik ten Hag is the right man to take Man United forward.
What's the plan?
And stick to the plan.
So what's the other plan?
Bounce back.
Yes, hello everybody and welcome back to The Truth. I, Sam Tai, am joined by Doogie Critchley.
Hello.
And Voice of God producer Jack Collins.
Hello Sam, how you doing?
To bring you episode 2, I'm fine and I'm not going to ask you the question back because I know you had a rotter of a weekend and we won't dwell on it, but you were here in spirit and in person and I appreciate your work ethic and hustle. Thanks to everybody who said very nice things about episode 1. Plenty of messages, very sweet, DMs all public. I got some that were genuinely just lovely to hear your voice, which is actually a really genuinely nice thing to say. But my favourite one was the 3 or 4 post thread slating Doogie,
really?
Which a guy put together, put the first 3 in, and then got no reply, and then came back 2 days later with more ammo.
Is this in a DM?
No, it's public. You can see it. I've just been chuckling away at it.
Did he tag me in it? I've missed
this. Yeah. Of course he missed it. Of course he did. Yeah. It was fantastic.
Well, you did say this on our WhatsApp group over the weekend. I was like, Sam, you can't say this and then not say what the content of the message is.
Well, you can see it. You go have a look if you want.
I thought it was a private DM. I'll have a look.
A quick word for the impact of our first episode, because we talked about Chelsea's transfer strategy. Mm-hmm. We pulled and we pushed and we picked holes in it. And then the day after, reports suggest that Todd Burley and Clear Lake are divorcing. And I can only assume it's because of us.
We were ahead of the game.
Right, this week we're talking Man United and we're talking Erik ten Hag. And the framing of the debate is this. No matter what happens, is it simply inevitable that ten Hag will lose his job this season? Because we are 3 games into the campaign and the pressure is already building. And off the back of what happened over the summer and even back into May, ahead of the FA Cup final, this is not what anybody at the club needed.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it was quite notable after the FA Cup final, wasn't it? That sort of famous Ten Hag quote of, you know, they can get rid of me, but I'll win trophies elsewhere. And it felt like quite a sort of mic drop moment. And it felt like he might have to look for a new job, but they did sound out other options, according to reports. Tuchel was considered, De Zerbi was considered. I'm sure they also approached other people as well. Eventually stuck with Erik Ten Hag, backed him a lot this summer, although they sold better than usual. So they did have a lower net spend than in previous years. But once again, we're coming into a third season after on the back of a really, really almost tragically bad year last year for a club of Man United's standard. It was so bad, saved by the FA Cup final. And now it feels like this was a sort of do or die season and it's not got off to a good start, as you say.
It hasn't, no. And it is strange when you look back over the tenure going into that third season, you do need to actually draw several lines in the sand when it comes to Erik ten Hag's tenure at United, because it feels like a long time ago. It technically isn't. The first season was really strong.
It was amazing.
Third in the league, 75 points, joint third best defensive record. And did it, can I just give him the credit, amid a backdrop of absolute nonsense from the ownership, from the Glazers. And there were times when it genuinely felt like Man United were about to cave inward from above and Erik ten Hag was stood there with his arms raised, holding the ceiling from and stopping it from collapsing. Like it was that simple. Like he did not just manage a football team that season. He managed like an ownership group. He managed a board. He managed an entire fan base and a club. And I had so much respect for him. And then they go into the second season and it's just absolute carnage, isn't it?
Yeah, it really wasn't good at all. I think what is clear that in the start of his first year, there were some big decisions made about high earners at the club. You know, Pogba leaving, Cavani leaving, Lingard, Matic, Mata, along with players that never really make it, like Eric Bailly and James Garner, etc. The signings that he brought in that summer, real mixed bag, like Lissandro Martinez and Casemiro, at least initially, mm-hmm. great impact.
He had a good first season, Casemiro.
Eriksen was okay. Antony's been a disaster. Malacia's just had so many injury issues. But you're right to say, you know, it was a really impressive first year. I said fantastic. Maybe that's a step too far, but it was definitely a huge upturn. It was their second highest points tally in the post-Fergie era. They beat Arsenal, Spurs, City, Chelsea in the league. And it came after that disastrous start when he loses to Brighton and Brentford in his first two games. First manager since 1921, which was John Chapman, to lose his first two games as Man United manager. But by mid-January, he turned it around so spectacularly that he became the first or the quickest to 20 wins for Man United. But then, as you say, the second year, from start to finish, was just a car crash. It was tragic.
Yeah, it was just absolutely horrendous. I mean, I sat there on a podcast last season for Who Scored, and myself and the panel every week, we played Man United shots conceded bingo as a game for fun. And it was whoever could guess the right number of shots conceded won the round. Typically, people were guessing 22 or 23. Like, just to contextualise it over the course of the season, because it wasn't just a bad patch, they conceded 660 shots, according to Opta, which is more than Derby County conceded when they were relegated in 2008 with the worst ever Premier League points tally. And 660 was just 11 fewer than Sheffield United that same season, who went down with 16 points. Now, if you don't want to read into that, fine. Look at the trusty old goal difference. Mm. The original underlying number that has held strong all these years. You can always rely on goal difference, Doogie. -1. Over 38 games, -1. Absolutely horrific. And it was not some freak, because over 38 games, you get a true measure of a team. And we all watched it, right? We all watched the defensive line back off or the front six pressed forward, 40 yards of space open up that Cobbie Mainoo was just like stood there. It looks like he needed a life jacket. It was so much, like, it was ridiculous. A tactical nightmare from Erik ten Hag that I think he was super stubborn and just simply refused to fix. He sat there and he told us all over and over again, it's because of injuries. And I don't buy it. I just don't think he thinks we're naive, and we're not. We know it's not just because of that. But right at the end of last season, there was a little tweak. They won their last two games. They sat off, possibly in preparation for this FA Cup final on the horizon, where they played City and they beat them. It was a great performance. They executed the game plan perfectly. And they've tweaked that game plan ever so slightly heading into this season. But I think they've tried to remain relatively true to the shape, at least. Problem is, obviously, a game plan for Man City is a very unique game plan. It doesn't really work across all levels. But I think they decided what they saw in those last three games of the season. So they beat Newcastle and one other club, Brighton, and then they beat City. I thought, yeah, we're going to press on with that. We're going to tweak it and tune it up. And we're going to go into this summer and we're going to buy players that fit this. So they spent, right?
They spent big. I mean, they have in his entire tenure as well. You know, his net spend in his time is £399 million. Man City's in his time is £8.9 million. So Man United have spent 45 times more than Man City as a net spend in that entire period. Only Chelsea have spent more in terms of net spend in that period. It's £100 million more than Arsenal, who have gone crazy in the transfer window by their standards in the last few years as well. Yep. Spurs, interestingly, are fourth, then Liverpool, then City. And look, you know, that's obviously as a result of the fact that City had very successful players that were able to be sold for a lot of money. They've been successful as a club. You know, it's not surprising that Man United needed to sell, because he did take over after a Ralph Rangnick sort of half season, which was pretty miserable. But for the regression to go on from your first to your second season is just really, really shocking. You know, their lowest position in the Premier League era, the last time they lost more than their 14 league games last year was in 1978-79. But his defenders will always come back to, well, he won a trophy. And even Man United fans that I would consider very informed, that I've worked with, that I enjoy listening to, just simply at the end of the season were like, well, we won a trophy. As if the previous 9 months was now irrelevant. And I just really struggle with that, because, yes, you went five seasons before his takeover without winning a trophy. You know, prior to Ten Hag, it was Mourinho in 16-17 with the Europa League as their last trophy. That was ages ago. But there's still the signs there. I mean, across his entire tenure, you go on goal difference, it's 14. It's not anywhere near good enough as well. And yes, there has been some tweaks this season that suggest that they have at least shored up defensively. But there are still issues.
I mean, we have a very small sample size. We have three Premier League games, but I do just want to dig into those stats a little bit, because I think there'll be some that Erik ten Hag himself will be very, very proud of, mm-hmm. and he'll be pointing to and saying, this is what I want, this is my model. So first three Premier League games so far, 11 shots per game, which is only the 15th highest figure in the Premier League. So offensively speaking, not great. Although, of course, in a small sample, who you play and like it will have a massive influence on these statistics. And they have played some Brighton strong teams. They've played Brighton and Liverpool. Only 11.7 shots against per game, though. This is a massive improvement from the 17 or so they averaged over the course of the season. But during the bad bit, the really bad bit, they were into 22, 23, 25. So 11.7 against, it's the eighth best tally in the league. That's an improvement. Here's the bit that Ten Hag will be pointing to right now and saying, this is what I want. 24 tackles per game, first in the league.
Huge.
12 interceptions per game, second in the league. He wants an aggressive team. You can see it. You can see he's tuning up that 4-2-4 that he's now putting out onto the pitch and saying, let's go hunting. Let's go hunting for the ball. And he's signing players that fit this system as well. Those are the stats that he'll be looking at and he'll be really proud of. The thing is, it's like usually the teams that are top for tackles and interceptions are in the bottom five of the league.
It's normally Sean Dyche's
because
side,
usually it's the teams that have many more defensive actions or many more opportunities to make those defensive actions. So while he'll be really proud of it, and I know he will because I listened to him speak and he talks about, you know, he specifically mentions things like high regains in his press conferences a lot. It looks to me like he measures the success of his team by how often they're able to turn the ball over in the attacking third, which is literally pressing. It's fine. But he'll be looking at this stuff and going, yes, yes. And there's a part of me that's like, I agree with you, Eric. And the other part of me is like, this is what Ipswich Town should have because they're the ones that are supposed to be subjected to this amount of defensive work. So I'm still not really sure where I fall on it. Now, what do you think of the new... the new game plan, the plan that he put into place maybe end of last season and has carried through into this season over the course of, you've got six games now to reference. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think I quite enjoy it, to be totally honest, because it does feel like some of their players are best suited to this style. Like, I do think Bruno Fernandes, this fits in very well. I think Mason Mount, one of the strongest parts of his game is his off-the-ball work rate when he's fully fit. It's clear that, you know, only Liverpool have won the ball in the opposition third more than Man United so far this season. And it has led to a notable upturn in terms of their defensive solidity. You know, Onana has only been forced to make four saves in three games. And yes, they've conceded a lot of goals, but that's probably down to not quite getting the balance quite right at the moment. And you put in the centre of the park an elite ball winner in Manuel Ugarte, he probably doesn't bring enough on the ball. He's not as, you know, as composed as maybe Pete Casemiro, which we've never really seen at Man United. But this is a player that can put up over six tackles and interceptions. That's a crazy number. You know, Kante at his peak was at about seven. So Ugarte should make a huge difference in front of the back line. And then, you know, you've got the emergence of two players last year that I think saved it from, I mean, it was a car crash. It was miserable, as we've already pointed out. But in Kobbie Mainoo and Garnacho, there's a lot of excitement there as well. And Hoyland, I think in glimpses, showed that there's a lot of promise there as well. And I actually really like some of the signings they made this summer, which is why I think there's very little excuses. You know, if you could draw up a dream summer and you're going for two centre-backs, and you come away with Lenny Yoro and Matthijs de Ligt for £80 million, £85 million, that's pretty much perfect. I think the price on Mazraoui, he's got so many injury issues, but I think that was very promising as well. And Joshua Zirkzee, Serie A Young Player of the Year, a very able backup, you know, an improvement on Anthony Martial. So I look at this summer and I think you've kind of been backed with a lot of players that you've wanted over the last 3 years. And I actually think this summer, the right age range, the right sort of level of quality, now is the time to really turn it on because they've got to be competing and competing hard for top four.
So I think the age range of these signings is really important and it taps into something you mentioned earlier in the conversation about how they hadn't, you know, their net spend was very, very high. Now, one of the reasons net spend could be high for any club is that they don't sell well. Yeah. You know, and obviously Manchester United have not sold particularly well over the last few years. You can't sell if you've got nothing to sell. And if you keep signing 30, 32, 35-year-old patch jobs, then you can't sell them for money. You can't make money. So your net spend is going to be pretty high. Like, think of all the strikers that they have tried to replace Romelu Lukaku with until they got to Rasmus Hojlund. It was a list of journeymen, which included Zlatan. It included Edinson Cavani.
Right, Weghorst.
Yeah, they've done very similarly with other areas, you know, in central defence with Raphael Varane. They've done so with Casemiro in spending a huge amount of money on him, knowing that they would get nothing for him in return, very likely. And that looks to be the case moving forward. Nowadays, you're looking at Leny Yoro, one of the best young centre-backs in the world. Certainly, from my perspective, I think that's if he's available, pay it. Spoken to a couple of people that know their stuff on centre-back scouting, and they're like, well, he's the best young central defender that's come out of France in since William Saliba. Mm. You know, it's high praise. And yet, if you're worried about exposing him to too much too soon, go ahead and bring in Matthijs de Ligt, who's very experienced for a 25-year-old. 25-year-old. He's played for 4 super clubs now. He's got hundreds of appearances under his belt. He'll be okay to spell in and out and move him in and out when Yoro is fit. That's great. And Lisandro is obviously the corner piece. They don't tend to win unless Lisandro Martinez is playing. Hopefully some of these signings can fit it. Xerxes, not the best finisher, not the most prolific striker, but a lovely link-up player, a tremendously hard worker, and someone who will probably improve them. And I think someone who they looked at and said, well, if we're running a 4-2-4, and we need someone to drop off the line and link, that guy. And he's Dutch, which is amazing for Erik ten Hag because he loves signing Dutch people. so great. And Mazraoui obviously is another former Ajax player that makes 6. Is it 6? Yeah. 6 players that Erik ten Hag has signed that once
he's got
played
a type
for Ajax. So like the more things change, the more things stay the same in some respects for Erik ten Hag, Man United and recruitment. Yes, they've come away with a, from one perspective, a hugely different haul of players with regard to age profile. And yet, 2 of them played for Ajax and 2 of them are Dutch.
So yeah, the whole new structure. Yeah. But it does feel like there was a little bit more thought in terms of the age range in these signings than there has been in previous summers.
Definitely. And they shipped out quite a lot as well, obviously, like finally moving on from Anthony Martial. And this might sound insignificant, but I think just being able to move on from some of those players, shift those wages, sure, but like also just like bring the Anthony Martial era to an end, finally, right? Move on from Raphael Varane, finally. And apologies if you're his biggest fan, because some of you probably are, except that Scott McTominay isn't good enough to play for Man United, and move him on and sign players like this. I like it. I come out of the winter a lot of snide this summer. Oh, how have you spent that much on Leny Yoro? He's only got 1 year left in this deal. Doesn't matter.
At that age.
It does not matter. Oh, Xerxes only scored 7 goals last year in Serie A. I think it was 7, wasn't it? Maybe it was 9. It was single figures. So what? He's brilliant at other things. So well done to them from that. But in doing this, right, this is where I found myself conflicted. I found myself praising Man United not only for lowering the age profile of the signings, but also praising Man United for signing players that I know fit Ten Hag's philosophy and his vision. Then you have to ask the question, was that a good idea in the first place? Because there is a chance that Erik Ten Hag and his vision is not the right way forward. So why would you sign players for it?
Question. What is Erik ten Hag's philosophy and vision?
Well, that is the question we're sort of dancing around. But I mean, look, when he came from Ajax, I feel like we all assumed that he was going to bring some elements of an Ajax style of play to the table, right?
Yeah.
It can't just have been me. Like, we thought that is like, yeah, okay, he'll bring possession football. Like, he's a Dutch football coach who worked for Ajax and he's basically said no to that. Mm. Like, it didn't appear for a while. We asked the question, when would it appear? And then about 6 months ago, he literally said, nah, not doing it. Not doing it. Like,
what did he say? He wanted to be the best counter-attacking team in the world.
Well, he mentioned, I don't know, did he say that?
Jeez. I think he said that.
Best
yeah.
transitional team
best
in the world.
Best team in transition.
And he also said that it's important to match a playing style with the philosophy and the DNA of a club, which I accept. And if you look in your dressing room and you've got Scott McTominay, then don't bother with tiki-taka.
No.
But over the course of 5 windows, you do get the opportunity to remould a squad to an intended style of play. And he's also largely avoided doing that because over the course of 5 windows, he's made very few strides towards possession football. So I think we can take him very seriously at his word when he said, I'm not here to do that at Man United, which left some fans really annoyed and really disappointed. And I can understand why, because if it's not that, then what is it?
Well, also, I think that is all well and good, bringing players that fit that style of play, but I don't think he's necessarily always stuck to it. Like, Antony does not fit a transitional team in any way. Like, he's clearly moved past Sancho because he's not, you know, explosive enough. I think that's mainly Jadon Sancho's biggest flaw, is that is he really quick enough?
He's not that fast.
He's not very fast.
That's fine.
I think that's fine to say. But it does feel like, you know, your biggest signing, the one that you stuck your neck on the line for, and yes, you didn't have very much help from a pretty loose structure, if you even want to call it a structure at that point, but Antony hasn't worked out. Hoyland, I think, will be a good player, but that is a very raw footballer, I would suggest, at the moment. Casemiro, your next biggest signing, fantastic for 1 year, terrible for a second. Now it feels like it's kind of not really wanted, but it'll be sticking around for the year because they need him to be there. And Mount's just been injury prone so far as well. There's not that many surefire successes. And yes, that's the, you know, the club's been struggling. Lisandro Martinez is probably their top signings, the one that's really stuck so far. But it's what I find frustrating about Man United and Ten Hag is when you think, oh, this is a change. You know, he's really cracked it now. There's a shocking result that's around the corner. You know, once he won the Carabao Cup in his first year, the next game they lost 7-0 to Liverpool. You know, there was this, you know, the end of last season, so positive. And even from the first game of this season against Fulham, I don't think they played particularly well. And it's not really caught a light as a campaign. And yes, there are mitigating factors in that. You know, you've got a whole new structure above you. You've got a number of new signings. They'll take a while to bed in. But are we seeing enough progress at the rate that there should be, given the fact that he's now in year three and he's had five windows and signed 21 players either on loan or permanently? Probably not. The thing that might sort of save him is that Man United still, and I think it really comes from the old Man United players that are still all across the media, are very stuck in what is a Man United manager. And it feels like if they weren't so stuck in that, I think they would have tried harder and maybe more successfully for Thomas Tuchel in this summer, because I do think he'd be a very good fit for Man United while they try and get back into title and trophy contention. So at the moment, I think the lack of alternatives that are seen as Man United type managers should probably save him.
I mean, we're in the wrong era for a Man United manager of the ilk that you're referencing. You know, we're largely past the idea that one man can stand at the helm of a club and manage so many elements of it so successfully. We're in the era of compartmentalizing managers' jobs, making them head coaches. We've literally renamed manager to something else. They're not managers anymore. They're head coaches. They coach the team. And then another set of people do another set of things. I mean, you just can't pine for the Sir Alex. And with the globalization of the sport, we know so much about so many of these managers, like Tuchel, better fit, but you know his style can get quite boring at times. So that's probably the other end of the extreme. It's more possession football, but it's way less exciting. I know some Man United fans who are very happy to watch Man United right now, because while they may be flawed, they are very exciting. The games are very end-to-end. The style...
I'd be having a heart week. Heart attack, like it or not.
And I think just to speak about the style a little bit, it looks very 4-2-2-2 or just 4-2-4. Now, I'm not a massive fan of this formation in principle. I remember first coming across it as a FIFA formation when some Brazilian teams were using it, and I thought it looked absurd. But RB Leipzig have very successfully used this, as have RB Salzburg over the years. They don't stick to it solidly. It's not always this, but they have used it in and out over the last 5 or 10 years to create some very good results. And they play direct, aggressive, pressing football. It is a formation that suits that style of play. And if you are playing with, say, Bruno Fernandes, who is very much a do-or-die passer, and you've got a fit Rasmus Højlund, who can run in behind and hit the channels and bustle up defenders, you've got Garnacho and Rashford, who really their main quality is that they are incredibly fast and direct. And then you add Manuel Ugarte into the middle with Kobbie Mainoo, and Ugarte is a warrior. He's a tenacious, ball-winning midfielder. I think, again, that it seems to me they've got a plan in mind. It's a pretty clear plan. I know Erik ten Hag always talks about the plan without really telling us what the plan is, but I think we can see it. And I have to give them credit for signing players and putting players in a position to succeed. The question, Doogie, becomes, is that enough? Like, is this, like, if they play to the maximum, to the optimum of Erik ten Hag's vision, are they anywhere near the top three, Liverpool, Arsenal and Manchester City?
I mean, on the basis of what we've seen so far this season, no. It still feels like they need to take a quite considerable jump to be even guaranteed or close to being in fourth place. You know, they're 6 points behind leaders City after three games. They're four behind fourth place Arsenal already. Arsenal haven't really got going so far this year, at least in terms of the sort of level of control that we saw last year. But, you know, teams like Brighton are a lot better than people expected. You know, Aston Villa haven't gone anywhere really. Newcastle will expect to, if they keep their squad more injury-free this year, get back into European contention.
Yep.
West Ham have just spent a vast amount of money. It's really, really competitive in that zone from 4th to 9th, yep. I think. And Man United, I think, I wouldn't be surprised if they finish 8th this year. I wouldn't be surprised if they finish 4th this year, but I would be very surprised if they're in the top 3. It just doesn't feel like a guarantee, and I think they're so frustratingly inconsistent even during games, during halves, you know, across games, across months. I never quite know what I'm going to get. Because it's so direct and they almost need to score what feels like the perfect goal because they are so uninterested in retaining possession in the final third, it feels like a lot of elements need to come off almost perfectly for them to score regularly, not concede at the other end and win. And I just don't know whether that is conducive in a Premier League which has become so possession orientated and which is being dominated at the moment by Pep and, you know, Arne Slot, hopefully for the title race sake, and Arteta. It just doesn't feel like his system is really in vogue at the moment.
See, I don't like saying this, but because I don't want all the football to look the same.
Exactly.
I don't want all the top teams to play in a very similar way because some of it can be quite sterile. However, the blueprint is the blueprint. The top teams play a certain way or variations of it and they succeed consistently. They control games. They score goals. They keep clean sheets. Go back to our old friend goal difference. Man City and Liverpool up there on +7. Like, the results speak for themselves. Man United are still engaging in basketball games, which I was heavily critical of them last season. And the tweaks that they've made to their approach in the last 5 games, plus the signings they made, they're doubling down on basketball. Like, they're not looking to pivot. They're not looking to become more like Man City and Liverpool and Arsenal. They're drifting further away to the other end of the seesaw. And as much as I love to see it from an entertainment perspective, I find it very difficult to get on board with when it comes to projecting actual success. So I don't know, Matt. I just cannot be convinced. I don't think anyone can convince me.
Well, I think across his entire tenure, their goal difference is 14.
Yeah.
I mean, how...
-3 again at the moment and...
You're not going to get into trophy contention. You can win probably an individual cup, but you can't consistently win in a league, I don't think, playing that style of football, at least in this current iteration of the Premier League.
You're not controlling enough elements over the course of 90 minutes. You're not controlling long enough periods to stop games from entering chaos.
Mm-hmm. I find it really interesting that Manchester United fans always reference Real Madrid when they're talking about Manchester United. They're the two clubs, I think, that have been brought up most together by a fan base. And I think you therefore go into what an Ancelotti team looks like, right? And the truth is that an Ancelotti team is very, very malleable and it can do lots of different things because they do have that element of playing off the cuff. I kind of look at that and I think, you know, you wouldn't say Real Madrid play like Man City do. You wouldn't say that Real Madrid play like this iteration of Liverpool. But I don't know what it is that Real Madrid has, apart from quite a lot of better players.
It's extreme quality, for
yeah,
sure.
But can you make an argument that there is something to be said for that? Equally, to the other extreme of this, are Erik ten Hag's Manchester United iteration right now just a slightly better version of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's? Because that's what I would be looking at.
Well, I don't think if you dial into it that they are even better than under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. You know, in Solskjaer's final full year in charge, United were 12 points off City. Last year, they were 31. You know, in his final full year in charge, they finished second. They finished 8th last year. They scored nearly 20 fewer goals. They conceded 14 more. It's very difficult to say they are better.
Is this an iteration of Manchester United that have better players, but actually arguably that makes things worse?
Well, exactly. And I think you make a really good point about Real Madrid, but they have, you know, players like Vinicius Jr. to rely on now, Mbappe. You know, Man United, one of their best players, is horrifically short of confidence in the moment in Marcus Rashford. You are relying on a Bruno Fernandes that can't do it all by himself. You've got two strikers that are under the age of 23, which I'm not against. I think it's a good strategy for Man United to try and grow with these players, you know, because they're not winning anything in the immediate future. Hopefully one of these stars becomes a hero, you know, elevates the team and on you go. But they are banking on some of their young players, Garnacho, Mainu, Hoyland, Xerxes, becoming some of the best players in the world. And at the moment, there feels like there's almost too much chaos going on at Man United in their style of play to maybe allow that to happen. I don't know.
Yeah, and Real Madrid always had Toni Kroos. You know, they had the ability to settle games down if they needed to, and they always had Tony, and for a long time they had Luka right next to him. And if they needed to keep the ball for 5 minutes, they just would. If Toni Kroos had to unlink himself from midfield or just drop into that left centre back space, just pick up the ball, just ping it around a bit, they would. They've been always very good, Real Madrid, and we've always praised them for being able to play in just about any game state. If it's calm, if it's chaotic, if it's somewhere in between, they can rise to the occasion. And I think what we know from watching Man United is that they only really want to play in one game state. And they force the game into that game state, and that makes it a more even playing field. And it's not just about injuries, and it's not just a one-season thing, because it has moved into the second season. They have doubled down on that strategy. They have bought players specifically to play right on the edge of the footballing margins. I just can't get my head around it, you know? And so if this is the manager choosing to do what he wants to do, over the course of 5 windows, he has made his choice. And he's even told us that he is not interested in bringing possession football to Manchester United. He's had the chances to move away from what he does, and he's just doubled down on it. And they don't have, in my opinion, the extreme player quality needed to actually come out the right side of these margins often enough to put them in contention for that top three. So it begs the question, what are the Manchester United chiefs happy with in terms of performance? Because if they're not happy with a lack of a challenge for those top three spots, which is, I imagine, what's going to happen for Man United this season, then they can't be happy with Erik ten Hag's approach.
Well, I mean, they strongly considered firing him after winning a trophy. So if they're not in contention for trophies this year, you imagine he's going to come under serious pressure. You look at Sir Jim Ratcliffe in the stands of Old Trafford the other day as they shipped 3, and it could have very easily gone to 4 or 5 against Liverpool. He did not look like a man that was enjoying watching his side, his boyhood club.
No.
And last year was, I know you almost can't emphasise it enough, tragically bad. I really do think it was so, so bad. You know, only 5 sides in Europe conceded more shots than Man United. That is shocking for a club of their calibre. But he was backed in the summer. I think they had arguably the best window in the Premier League. And, you know, Chelsea fans have said for summers now, oh, we've won the window. And it actually means absolutely nothing. But in this case, I do think he got their dream midfielder. They kept on saying he was their number one target. They signed a very able backup in Joshua Zirkzee. I've already gone over it. De Ligt, Mazraoui. These are very good players for where Man United are right now. I'd say they've got lucky bringing in the level of player they have, having just finished 8th in the Premier League. So now has to be a serious upturn.
Right, okay. My mind is made up. Erik ten Hag, the sacking is inevitable this season. I don't see how he can produce the results necessary. I don't see how he can get close enough to the top three to satisfy the expectation around United, especially after such a strong summer, because I don't think the playing style that he has doubled down on and he has chosen can control games to that point and make them consistent enough.
I tend to agree. I think he might last the season, but probably go in the summer. And you imagine that they'll have to probably pick someone that follows a similar idea. Maybe someone like Andoni Iraola would be quite an interesting pick for Man United going forward.
Because they've built the squad in this
image. And I think Man United will be very entertaining. I think they'll go through patches of winning games, and it will be, you know, suddenly there'll be huge upturns in terms of how the media talk about them, how we talk about them on podcasts, etc. But there won't be enough consistent results to get into top three contention. I think he'll lose his job as well.
I suppose there's a chance that all those Ajax players he's bought just suddenly start playing possession football of their own accord.
Yeah.
Or maybe if they brought in a possession-focused coach, he turns around and goes, oh, hang on a minute.
I've got
one of the best ball-playing goalkeepers in world football that Erik ten Hag is not utilising to the best of his ability. I've got Matthijs de Ligt and Lissandro Martinez at centre-back.
I've got
Kobbie
right
Mainoo in dropping into midfield. I mean, actually, if you think about it, the bones for that type of football are there. So maybe it wouldn't be as big a adjustment, but Ugarte, for example, survives in one type of ecosystem. So they are nailing their colours to the mast on that one. Okay, closing comments, producer Jack.
Ralf Rangnick would love this squad.
Yes, he would.
He came out this week and said, oh, by the way, did you see I was right?
Yeah.
I did enjoy that, but it did make, you know, just saying that though, like if Manchester United are going to move on from Ten Hag, well, you spoke about Leipzig, you spoke about Salzburg. Should they be looking into that school, right? Like surely if you then want a manager that's going to continue down this line, you go, right, we'll have Marco Rosa. Thank you very much. That would be the person that sits in this and works with it. I don't know. The only thing I would say, and the only question I would pose to you both before we go, is what is success if it does it have to be in the league? So if United finish fourth and they win the Europa League and they win the Carabao Cup again, let's say, is that a successful season? Because I think that by the definitions that Erik ten Hag has laid down on the map, he'll be like, that's success. And to a point, and maybe this is kind of been lost in the kind of general sense of things a little bit. I mean, how many clubs win a trophy on a regular basis? Very few. And so if you imagine that City's dominance is so, you know, abrupt at this point that it looks like no one is going to win it, it looks like we're watching a Bayern kind of dominance or a Juventus kind of dominance. Is there a point that you can make in Erik ten Hag's defence that is purely being in that conversation for a trophy every single year is success within itself?
So I like the thinking, and you're right. Like, if it feels like a closed shop above, then if you nail your trophies, and he's got two, like two more than most,
yeah, and reached another FA Cup final,
then he can point to that as success. You have to be careful with it though, because they've slipped very far away from the top three, very, very far. And if they continue to be that far away, or slip even further away, and spend 2, 3, 4 years outside of Champions League football, which is a legitimate threat at this point, Things start to change. The caliber of players that we have lauded them for bringing in this summer, you even said you're quite surprised, or they've got quite lucky to attract these. They're still Man United. They're still only 1 year removed from Champions League football, but that picture starts to change if the underperformance continues.
Yeah.
So that's the difficulty.
I also think one thing that Erik ten Hag, you know, fans will be probably screaming at their phones or wherever they're listening to this, is we haven't maybe caveated, you know, he has had some very difficult scenarios to go through, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, other forwards that should remain nameless, the Sancho situation. He's had a lot of crap thrown at him. And look, last year was a disaster, but I do think there's been some really bright moments under him. But it's just that overall picture just does look a little bit worrying. But then it's potentially only a year till Pep Guardiola leaves. You know, Arne Slot's new at the job. You know, Arteta, you know, he looks to be the next one ready to dominate, but who knows? So it needs to improve fast on the basis of last year. But I do kind of agree with Jack. Maybe he can stay in it with a fifth place and a good trophy attempt.
Yeah, well, you just got to be careful not to fall into that trap, say like last year where they won the trophy and it just seemed to paper over the cracks when everything was not fine at all. Absolutely not fine at all. Right, that's it. Erik ten Hag, we can get back to the weekend of football, agonising over his future, scrutinising his every hand waving and step that he takes on the touchline.
Poor guy, it is relentless.
And it is, and we're adding to it, but it's very interesting. It's never dull for Manchester United. Right, thank you very much to you, Doogie.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much to you, Jack Collins.
Always a pleasure, Sam.
And to you, dear listener, 2 down. Thanks for sticking with us. See you same time next week.